Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always, all you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, title gives it away. I'm here to talk off the stories of film, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all those ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. This particular episode of Film Stories is one of my occasional special episodes where I bring on a filmmaker to talk about their body of work. I'm really, really thrilled and delighted to be joined in the conversation you're about to hear by writer and director Billy Ray. Now, in an extensive chat, we're going to cover a fair amount of his career and his thoughts and his work. Just a few notes by way of setup then. Amongst the things that we talk about is a podcast series that he did for the Deadline website during the Writers Guild of America strikes in 2023. So we reference that. That podcast is out there. In fact, it's pretty much what we start the conversation talking about. The TV series Earth 2 was from 1994 to 1995. We'll also touch on a few of the projects that Billy Ray has written, but there are just so many of them, it's quite hard to cover them all in one particular episode. So I've kind of cherry-picked a little bit. I don't think I specifically mentioned what the Clint Eastwood project that he wrote was. It is 2019's Richard Jewell. And a couple of times in the conversation, up come the names The Last Tycoon and The Comey Rule. This was a pair of television projects that Billy Ray both wrote and directed. Other than that, I think everything's pretty much explained by the conversation you're about to hear. So I'm going to set it up with a bunch of clips from a trio of Billy Ray's projects. You're going to hear a clip from 2007's Breach, then from 2013's Captain Phillips, and then 2003's Shattered Glass. The conversation starts the other side of those clips, but do you know what? Just going to roll them.
You're going to be an agent.
Say it again, okay?
You're going to be an agent.
You're being tasked to headquarters, where you'll be riding the desk of an agent named Robert Hanson, considered our most knowledgeable analyst on Russian intel. He's also a sexual deviant. This could mean a huge embarrassment to the Bureau. You're going to keep an eye on him for us.
Tell me 5 things about yourself, 4 of them true.
They're coming in fast.
This is Mask, Alabama.
We are an unarmed freighter. We have 2 skiffs approaching with armed intruders.
Potential piracy situation.
Copy, Alabama. You should alert your crew and get your fire hoses ready.
There are 16,800 magazines in this country. But only one calls itself the in-flight magazine of Air Force One. And that's the thrill of working at the New Republic. This kid, he hacked his way into a company called Juked Micronics and posted the salary of every Juked employee on Juked's website, saying the big bad bionic boy has been here, baby. I want a Miata. I want a trip to Disney World.
It's funny.
That was a selection of clips from the work of screenwriter and director Billy Ray, who I'm delighted is joining me for a Film Stories podcast special today. Hello, Billy Ray. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's raining. I think we've both agreed we're 8 hours apart and thousands of miles apart, but we're united by rain.
That's right.
I was watching a film last night. I don't know whether you've seen it, Leave the World Behind, which has popped up on Netflix. And without going into spoilers, there's a sequence where they walk in and discover this huge shelf of DVDs. I mean, it's just beautiful. It's film nerd bliss. And the first DVD I saw on the shelf was Breach. No, the spine of it just sticks out an absolute mile. I'd be fascinated to see if you see it too. And it's an odd place to start, but because I watched the film last night, it's right at the top of my head. Because then I tried to watch Breach again ahead of this, and I only have it on the HD DVD format, which is now defunct and the player is long gone. So I bought not available on streaming in the UK anywhere whatsoever. You can't even buy. And I'm just kind of, it felt to me like almost an audit of where the world of independent and low budget film is now, that accessibility has become part of the problem. I'm just curious, before we get into the meat of it, if you're finding that as well.
Yes, it's mortifying when you go to look for work you've done and you can't find it on streaming. I'm not very tech savvy, so I never seem to know where to go or how to find things. But I grew up in a business in which things were always on film. So one way or another, you could always go get them and get your hands on them tangibly one way or another. And I know a lot of filmmakers that struggle with this too.
Well, I'm a print magazine nerd at heart, also been writing on the internet for years. And the same thing's happening with articles you write on the internet as well. It's just like that they're just being deleted to make the internet go faster. I wish I was making this up. But I listened to for listeners who won't know this, you did during the Writers Guild strikes some podcast work with Deadline, including one where you interviewed an AI.
Yes.
Which I think was the other mortifying state of the industry moment as well, that you were talking to this effect. I mean, you'd edited it, but you're talking to this chatbot that was giving perfectly functional box tick answers to everything. You couldn't even describe the answers as bad. They were just really, really bland and empty and nothing. And you seem to be leading a mini fight against that.
Well, when the strike began, Deadline approached me and a producer named Todd Garner and asked us to co-host a podcast about the strike. And I had a lot to say about it, so I agreed to do one. And what I found was, having done that one episode, it touched a nerve in people. And the next time I was on the picket lines at Fox, people kept coming up to me. People who shouldn't have recognized me by face came up to me, talked to me about the impact that the podcast had had on them. So we kept going and we started to interview people. And then Todd actually had to go to Australia to make a movie in the middle of a strike. So I took over the podcast by myself. And one of the first things I did was interview AI. I really wanted to scare people, and I knew I didn't have to manufacture anything in order to achieve that. I had a professor at MIT and his team, brilliant, brilliant man named Simon Johnson, set up a text-to-voice function on the chatbot, and asked it a bunch of questions, and that that particular episode took our podcast to a different level. No question about it. It changed the way people around here in LA were talking about the podcast. Definitely gave us tremendous exposure and a massive tailwind. And then a few weeks later, I brought the chatbot back, and this time had it programmed to answer me in the voices of Morgan Freeman, Emma Watson, Chris Rock, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that really scared the crap out of everybody here. Yeah, I have very strong feelings about AI, and I wanted to make sure that other people shared them.
I do like the fact you asked the chatbot in the midst of it all. Do you think the chatbot could be a studio head? That a lot of the emphasis on where AI is going in the industry is it's replacing ground floor jobs. But I think your argument was as much as if you can do that, surely you can do the one at the top as well.
And it agreed. It said that it could.
It did agree.
I said to it, "Have you ever listened to this podcast before?" And it said, "No." Yes. And I said, "Well, having been a guest, do you think you could host this podcast?" And it said, "Yes." And it thought it could be a teacher. It thought it could do all kinds of jobs. It thought it could be a UPM. It thought it could direct. Why wouldn't it?
Well, the terrifying thing is the wrong people seem to be listening to it. That can say whatever it likes. It's generally who's listening, isn't it? It tends to be the problem. In Cheery, I've been digging. If I can dig a bit more back into your career, because I think the Jetsons predicted an awful lot of the future. It's one of the most tenuous links I could possibly do, but I'm owning this. I loved the Jetsons growing up, and I didn't appreciate till I was doing some digging into you that was your first paid screenwriting gig.
My first sale, I was 19. It was the summer after my sophomore year at UCLA. Hanna-Barbera had an open writer's call. They wanted to do 41 more Jetsons episodes. They had done a bunch in the 60s. And it was just an open call. I went in and pitched two ideas. They bought one, paid me to write it, which got produced, and stole the other, which also got produced, but without any compensation to me.
What was your, I have to, I used to love the Jetsons. What was your Jetsons episode? You remember
Jetsons episode was called High Moon. And it was about how George was afraid that Elroy had completely lost sight of what true heroism was and wanted to tell Elroy the story of their great, 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 great ancestor, George Jetrock, who had been in the Old West and who had fought a gunfight against a bad guy named Bad Bart. And it was about George telling that story to Elroy.
Did you secretly just want to write a Flintstones episode? So you just cheated?
No, I wanted to do one Jetsons and get the hell out of there. You do it once and you're a hero in your fraternity. You do it twice and you're just a guy who writes for the Jetsons.
But I mean, you had that level of foresight at 19. That's the unusual, because I mean, a lot of writers very early in their career, we're told or they're told, scramble for any job you can. And appreciating your dad had a literary agent, I think your dad.
My father was a literary agent and actually knew Hanna and Barbera, which was the company that made.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And I didn't want them to know that he was my father. I didn't want to get in there on nepotism. So I sold it under the name Bill Allen. And when they gave me the check for the script, I couldn't cash it. And I literally had to go to Hanna's office and say, "Listen, Rick Ray is my father. My name's Billy Ray. I need a new check." And they issued me a second check with my real name.
Do you remember watching it then? Your first produced piece of work? Did you feel some ownership of it? Or you, if you were so keen to get out, was that...
It was definitely ominous, because I went to the day that they recorded it. And I was sitting in the lobby looking through a script, and I said, "Who wrote this script?" And they said, "You did." And it was my episode, but it had been rewritten in a pretty hacky fashion by a director. And I went into the recording booth. I was 19. Try to restore the script. And he put up with me for about a half hour, and then he kicked me out.
So your version of like the Fablemans or something like that would be offending the director of the Jetsons.
Yeah, which I think is funnier.
Yeah, yeah, I'm in. I think you should do that. You talked there about, and I know you're very active in the Writers Guild of America and been very active campaigning and fighting for better deals for writers. You talked there about there was an open writers call that by the sounds of it was almost blind to where the writer was, the age of the writer and stuff like that. Do you find that still present in the industry? Do you find some of those ways in have been bricked off?
I find that it's done now, but in a more sophisticated way.
Yeah.
In other words, a studio will put out word, okay, we're going to make the Slinky movie.
Yeah.
Right. And we're going to take pitches for the Slinky movie. They're not going to have a room with 60 writers in it and have people come in one at a time, which is how they did the Jetsons, by the way. It literally was a cattle call. But what they will do is they will have producers of the Slinky movie take meetings with any writer that wants to.
Yeah.
And there is no Writers Guild regulation that requires the studio to tell the writer ahead of time how many writers that writer is competing with.
Yeah.
So the writer might be competing with 50 writers for that gig. And one producer might be hearing 50 pitches for that gig.
Yeah.
There is a regulation that states that if the writer or the writer's agent asks how many other writers are competing for that gig, they have to be told.
Yeah.
It's you know, don't ask, tell.
Yeah.
At that moment, the writer can decide whether or not to put in that level of sweat equity, and some do and some don't. But of course, the trouble with it is that any producer or any studio or any entity that hears that many pitches of one idea is just out of human nature going to start to blur some of those lines. And ultimately, you're going to have a bunch of people's ideas making their way into the finished product. You're going to have sort of a Frankenstein's monster version that ultimately gets made. And then someone will sue the studio and someone will win because their ideas got pitched.
So when you're developing TV shows and when you're meeting writers, what's your ideal way to do it? How do you treat writers who work with you?
Well, in the show that I'm in the middle of right now, there's a show that I sold right before the strike to Paramount Plus with Robert De Niro attached. And the agreement with Paramount Plus was that I would write episode one, I would write episode two, and then I would give them a format for all of season one.
Yeah.
And then they would decide whether or not they were going to make the show, not a pilot. They were either going to make season one or not make anything. So I said to them, okay, well, you want me to break an entire season of television? And I had pitched, you know, a very detailed version of the show. So I knew where I was going.
Yeah.
But you want me to break 8 episodes for that format? I'm going to need a writer's room. And they said, okay, you can have 2 writers. I said, it's a season of television. I need 4. And they said, okay, we'll compromise 2. And so I got 2 writers and we went into a room and we were 4 weeks into that writer's room when the strike began.
Yeah.
And by that point, I had decided that I was going to write episode 1 and these other 2 writers were going to write episode 2 as a team. And that I was going to put their name on the format as well as mine, and that it was going to be the creation of all of us.
Yeah.
I think that's how you build a team.
I hadn't appreciated either that you were the because I'm a movie nerd by trade. Movies have always been my thing, but I was also aware of Earth 2. Okay. Which I didn't know. now this is an audio podcast, so listeners can't quite get the face that you made there, but I'm not spotting fondness for Earth 2 just in your response there. But that was an Amblin show. That's a reasonably big deal.
It's so funny when you go through someone's career, and I've been at this a long time.
Yeah.
You know, you tend to want to do your greatest hits. And every once in a while, someone wants to talk about things at the beginning of your career, which were much more humbling experiences. Earth 2, I think, was 1993.
Yeah.
Amblin called and said, we want to do a Wagon Train, but set in outer space.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was an exciting idea. And I didn't really have any dreams of doing television at that point. I was just doing features, but it was Amblin, which meant I'd be in the same building as Steven Spielberg. So I said yes. So I came in and started to develop it and I gave it its name. And then what wound up happening was I wrote what at the time was, I don't know if it still is, but at the time, it was the longest show Bible ever written. It was at the time, it was 93 pages of just single space information about the show. And it was determined that in order to go sell that show, we were going to need more experienced writers to write the pilot. So they went out and got three writers from Law and Order.
Yeah.
And those three said, yeah, okay, we'll write the pilot and we'll run the show. But adios, Billy. So I was paid off and sent away. And they took my 93-page Bible, walked into NBC and sold the show. And that was my last connection to it. That was it. They sold my Bible. So I got screen credit as one of the creators, and I got screen credit as on the pilot, just because I had laid out what the pilot story was. And that was, I never had any more contact with the show after that.
So that's two of your earliest produced pieces of work, where it'd be fair to say you got very early exposure to the rough side of the industry.
Oh, everything I did for the first 12 years in the business was appalling. Oh yeah, so, I mean, I was just getting abused right and left, and there was a certain point where I was going to quit. I remember very clearly saying to my wife, "I'm not helping anybody. Like, I'm making a living, but I'm not making a contribution to my industry at all. And I think I'm going to go be a fireman. I mean, at least maybe I'll get a cat out of a tree. Maybe I'll do something of use." And that's how it went for the first 13 years of my career. My credits were a complete embarrassment to me. The things that had been made, I didn't think were interesting. The things I'd written that I thought were interesting hadn't been made. It changed when I directed for the first time, when I made this little movie called Shattered Glass. My career completely changed at that moment.
But the films, because I was listening to an interview you did earlier today, and you talk about that 10-12 year period where you were writing pretty much nonstop. There were projects left, right, and center. It's just none of them made it to the screen. I think the first
The ones that did weren't terribly good.
Well, the first one I remember of yours coming to the screen, the first film, was Color of Night, which I just remember
not at all, and it's a movie I've never seen.
Well, it was a movie that was just overtaken by arguments between people, and I knew nothing at that stage. I was curious if you were just blocked out.
I wrote that as a novel when I was 23.
Yeah.
Couldn't sell it. And then when I became a screenwriter, I wrote it as a spec, sold it, Bruce Willis attached, promptly got fired, got rewritten by a guy named Matthew Chapman. That's the script that Richard Rush went off to direct. I read the shooting script. There wasn't a line of mine in it.
Yeah.
I called my agent and I said, I got to take my name off this. And he said, you've never had a movie made. You can't take your name off of it. And so I took his advice and I left my name off it and on it and made money. I mean, there must be a Color of Night channel, because every once in a while I'll get a check that is sort of astonishing from that stupid movie, but I've never seen it. And creatively, it for a long time was the worst creative experience of my career. It got supplanted later, but for many years, it was the worst creative thing that had ever happened to me.
And to be clear, the reason I ask these questions and I go into this is I'm not trying to dig into like bad memories in your life. It's just I'm an outsider to the film industry, and no one talked the way you're talking now. When I was growing up, and I do think if you show the fallibilities and put the human being at the start of the industry, it does make it more accessible. It's why that open writing slot very early on for the Jetsons is interesting, and it's why stories of, and I'm not trying to bring up bad memories, but it's why stories of the films that people don't talk about I find are really quite interesting, because I think that's where you get a bit of the color and a bit more of the reality of it all.
I agree.
I went down a rabbit hole of, because one of the things researching you, apart from A, you're really hard to research by the fact that there's a Billy Ray who was a producer on Perry Mason in the 80s. So I get loads of results on that. Obviously, there's another Billy Ray. Billy Ray's also a Robert Zemeckis film that nearly got made as well. And so all of these things just kind of got in. But there was a point in the night, I think it was in 1997, where I found just in what I don't think I've ever seen this from a writer before. So many projects on the go from one writer in 1 year, reported in the trades as if they're happening, that then just kind of petered out. Because I think you'd done Volcano at that point, the film with the finest tagline of that year. I will defend the coast is toast till the end of my days.
Would I?
But there was a film, for instance, you were doing with F. Gary Gray called The Last Day that I don't think came through in the end. Yeah, I think Legalese did happen in the end. There's a TriStar remake of Camille. And this was just three paragraphs just at the bottom of the trades from a writer who at that point you had one or two credits to your name. But I was reading stuff like that when I was, you know, when I was completely away from the industry. And that felt unusual to me to see, you know, just not a big name writer at that stage attached to so many things. How many things were you kind of juggling at that point? Because the rabbit hole of your projects that didn't happen is quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And each of them, you know, was a child for a while. Yeah. There was also Friday Night Lights. I was one of the writers on that. There were a bunch of them in that period. And all very well intended, and all of them had their moment where they looked like they were happening. That's part of the game. It's part of the frustration, and you have to learn how to accept it. You know, when you are a screenwriter, you have to begin to think of it as a relay race, and you run your lap, and you hand the baton off to the producer. And you can follow the producer around if you want, but you can't really change the way they run their lap.
Yeah.
And you got to hope that they hand the baton off to a director. And then you can follow the director around if you want, but you can't really change how they're going to run their race either. And if they drop the baton, there's really not a lot you can do. I mean, you just keep saying, hey, I'm here. If you need me, if you need a new draft, I'll do it. If you need work on that character, I'm there. But you can't make them do their job.
Yeah.
And but there's a frustration there.
You say that in such a matter of fact and calm way that I mean, at what point were you able to accept it at that level? Because I think for upcoming writers listening to this, that's going to be one of the hardest things. You talked there of the 12 years that you had where you nearly walked away. What were the things that stopped you walking away? And what was the point where you accepted this is the process?
What stops you from walking away ultimately is that you got in it because you love it. You care desperately about movies.
Mm.
You want to do the kind of work that, you know, William Goldman and Alvin Sargent and Billy Wilder did that you so admired. You want to leave behind a legacy that would make your kids proud. You know, you haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
And so your work is just not finished. As I said, what changed everything for me was directing. Once I had made Shattered Glass, all those unmade scripts in the past, they just didn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
Because now I could say to anybody in Hollywood, okay, you give me a camera and this budget and I'll go do this. Yeah. This is the kind of storytelling that I want to go do. And it turns out that my industry was interested in that. And so it gave me the opportunity to make Breach and other things that followed. And all of a sudden it makes everybody look at your past in a different way. They stop thinking, oh, the scripts didn't get made because they weren't good enough. And they start thinking, oh, why didn't Billy just direct those? They would have been made by now.
There was a point where you said that it was in 2001 that you stopped being embarrassed about your writing, though. Was that the point of just setting Shattered Glass up? Was that?
Yes.
Okay. So even when you hadn't made it at that point, even when you hadn't shot it or anything like that, that was a point where that there was a vein of confidence had kind of opened up a little bit. It's a terrible metaphor, but I'm going to stick with it.
I found a rhythm that had to do with telling a true story and researching it like a journalist, which was my past. And all of a sudden I thought, this is a good gear for me.
Yeah.
I can go and do the research like a journalist would, but then tell it like a screenwriter would. And I knew I could make credible movies in that way. And, you know, Captain Phillips and Richard Jewell and the Comey Rule, they all came out of that same sort of rhythm. Find a story that matters, investigate the hell out of it, tell it credibly, and get out of its way.
And I mean, there was a point, I think it was the year before Shattered Glass came out, where Heart's War obviously came out as well. But the Heart's War, I think, was 2002. And yeah. The story that I was reading in the trades earlier was off the back of the screenplay for Heart's War, before anyone had actually seen the film, that got you four other jobs, that yes. Your stock had risen. I mean, again, that seems, I mean, one of them was it the Napoleon of Crime?
Yes,
with a Robert Redford 19th century project, stuff like that. But these were, these weren't like glib one-line projects or anything like that. From what I'm reading, these were four very tangible things that came out of one screenplay that was very well regarded in Hollywood. I'm just wondering what it was like at the center of that, knowing you had Shattered Glass around the corner as well.
It was a really heady time. It was exciting and not without its frustrations, but I was getting opportunities to write for people that, you know, mattered to me.
Yeah.
One of which was Redford, obviously. I mean, the trick with Napoleon of Crime was that Redford, as Redford sometimes does, was supposed to be playing a character that was, you know, 30 years younger than he was.
Yeah.
Like when he played, you know, high school in The Natural.
Yes.
That was some tough sledding, but again, I'm proud of all those scripts and would be happy to make any of them now.
There was another that I caught in the midst of them, because it struck me just looking at the credits of some of your films. One of the key turning point relationships was Paula Wagner and Tom Cruise.
For sure.
That you were hired to adapt, I think it was a GQ article called Metamorphosis, which yes. didn't happen, but then that paved a path to other projects. So how did that relationship come about, and then how did it continue from there? And then I am going to come on to Shattered Glass.
Well, this takes us to Shattered Glass.
Of course.
The Shattered Glass started as an article in Vanity Fair that was set up at HBO.
Yeah.
The executive at HBO was named Gay Hirsch. She's the one who hired me to write Shattered Glass. While I was writing, Gay and the guy above her and everyone else in that administration was fired by HBO, which is why I think I write so fast now. Because yeah. I want to make sure that I turn it into the person who hired me before they get blown out of their job.
Yeah.
But anyway, Gay then went to work for Cruz Wagner and therefore brought me over to Cruz Wagner to adapt that GQ article called Metamorphosis, which was about an artist named John Sarkin.
Yeah.
That got me into the world of Paula Wagner. And then when the new administration came into HBO and didn't want to make Shattered Glass and it sat for 2 years, I was able to go to Paula and say, can you get this out of there for me? And she did. And so Paula, along with Craig Baumgarten and Gay, they were the main frontline producers of Shattered Glass.
How far then into the Shattered Glass writing process before you knew you were going to direct it?
Oh, I had written it and it had sat for 2 years before I considered directing it. It was making Heart's War that made me want to direct Shattered Glass.
What was it about Heart's War that made you want to direct it?
We were shooting in Prague in January, which is incredibly cold. And we were shooting an exterior and a prisoner of war camp scene, and everybody was freezing their ass off. And I was sitting in a warm trailer as the screenwriter. And something about that felt wrong to me. I felt like I wasn't standing on the front line of my own movie. I wasn't like suffering enough. And it was time to find out if I was enough of a grown-up to direct a movie. And Shattered Glass made sense because it had no car chases. It had no gunplay. It had no nudity. It had no explosions. It had none of that craft level stuff that I knew I had no idea how to direct. It was just, could you capture tone and could you capture performance?
And by the time you came to direct it, I mean, you said you were on the set for Heart's War, and also you'd done a lot of rewrite work, which listeners may or may not know about. So had you been present on lots of sets at that point? Were there people you were watching and kind of just taking little bits of inspiration from close up?
I'd been on plenty of sets, but that really wasn't the issue for me. The issue for me was cold calling a bunch of first-time directors and saying, can I take you to lunch and ask you some questions? And it was, you know, Brian Helgeland and David Goyer and Ed Solomon, you know, writers who just directed for the first time, who all stopped what they were doing and sat down with me. And I took a notebook and I said, okay, where are the landmines for first-time directors? What really surprised you out there? What do you wish you knew going in that you know now? I interviewed them. And then I interviewed a bunch of producers that I had written for. And I said, okay, you've worked with first-time directors. Where do they screw up? And I took notes. And I said to them, what about me as a first-time director would concern you? And of course, you hope that they're going to say nothing. You're going to be awesome. But I remember one of them, his name is Lucas Foster, saying, you belabor the point. And I said, you mean as a person or as a writer? He said, both. I said, oh, fuck. Okay. I'll try not to belabor the point. And then I got great advice from Lawrence Bender.
Right, of course.
Lawrence Bender said, use your auditions as directing practice. That's where you learn how to craft performance, is in auditions. Learn how to do it there. And I remember someone else saying to me, when you're in a production office and you walk in the morning, before you put your bags down, stick your head into every single office and say, good morning, how are you today? Do you have any questions for me? And you'll learn what everybody does for a living. Yeah. You'll learn what they're contributing to your movie in prep so that when you're shooting, you won't have to ask. I got incredible advice and I took it.
Well, it's the second bit that people don't tend to do a lot of the time, the actual taking of advice. I remember reading, I think it was it's an anecdote that I come back to lots and lots, but Nicholas Heitner, after years of directing at the National Theatre in the UK, his first feature as director was The Manners of King George.
Yes,
and it's a great film, but also he wrote in one of his books afterwards that he directed in his view, and I say this as someone who loves Breach, which I'm coming to shortly, he directed in his view his best film when he knew the absolute least about what he was doing. And I just wonder a little bit about just capturing the naivety about at the point of where you know enough but not too much, and how adequately you are able to measure something like that.
It's hard to say. I mean, I look back at Shattered Glass, and I'm so fond of that movie. And I'm proud of that movie, but I'm constantly aware when I look at that movie of just how many times I was saved by other people.
Yeah.
By my DP, by my AD, certainly by my editor, my composer, by my cast. I mean, I had people who kept me from stepping on landmines all day long on that movie. And I do feel that as I've directed more, I've learned more, and I've gotten a little bit more sophisticated. I don't know if I've gotten better.
Yeah.
But I certainly know where the blind alleys are more now. And, you know, the last time I directed was a miniseries for Showtime called The Comey Rule. Where, you know, we were taking on things that I think might have overwhelmed me as a first-time director, that I needed all the experience that I had to make that. And I look back at the season of television I did for Amazon on The Last Tycoon.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could have directed that when I first started directing. I think I visually got a little bit better. I hope so anyway. But it all comes down to the same basic rules. About always knowing what story you're telling, always making sure that every decision is conspiring to tell that story. And then in terms of leading a crew, just ducking the credit for everything that goes well and taking the blame for everything that goes badly. and getting the best work out of people.
You read anything on the making of Chinatown, and the team there always say they were saved by people all around them as well. So, you know, I get the impression that's not particularly uncommon for film sets, but still, the point where you're at the fulcrum of 1,000 decisions a day, I mean, say 4 days into the shoot of Shattered Glass, where was your headspace? Did you feel that this was home, or were you still a little bit bewildered by it?
I never felt bewildered, ever.
Yeah.
Even on the first day, I didn't feel bewildered. But I did feel every day that, like, the DGA police were going to come in with handcuffs and just take me away and say, well, you didn't really think we were going to let you direct the movie, did you? I felt tremendous imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
I just knew that there was so much I didn't know that it was shocking to me. Every day that they let me walk on that set, I was surprised. And the only way I could live with it was I was the best prepared director I had ever seen. I had shot listed fanatically. I had made so many notes about performance and production, and I would, if I was going to fail,
yeah,
it was going to be because I wasn't talented enough. It wasn't going to be because I didn't work hard enough.
How as a director did you see that casting changed the film? Because I mean, I'm a huge fan of Shattered Glass. I've come off the fence now. I was trying to be all like professional and stuff like that, but I'm a huge fan of Shattered Glass. And you've got this duo at the heart of it. You've got Hayden Christensen, who, as you know, was getting all sorts of blowback by the time that the film came out, and then people saw what he could do. Then you've got this Peter Sarsgaard performance, which just, I mean, incredible piece of work. But the casting bit, presumably to you, was new. And I'm just wondering how you navigated that.
Well, the movie got made because of Hayden.
Yeah.
Hayden was going to be in Attack of the Clones. Everybody thought he was going to be Harrison Ford. That's why Lionsgate was investing the money.
Yeah.
So Hayden, it wasn't even there was no choice there. That's what we were doing. We were making a movie with Hayden. But I called him one day and I said, hey, Hayden, have you ever been in a temple? He said, no. I said, well, you're playing someone who's Jewish. I'll come pick you up Friday. I'm going to take you to Friday night services at a temple. And then I did.
Yeah.
And we started to just sort of build the character. I took him into a temple and I said, okay, pick any two people here. They're your parents. And we started to talk about what it was like to be a journalist. And we started to talk about what it was like to write for a living. And we just started to build it block by block. The Sarsgaard character, Chuck Lane,
incredible.
That came down to either Sarsgaard or Greg Kinnear.
Right, okay.
The studio wanted Kinnear. I was a first-time director and I didn't have the strength to fight back. And I love Greg.
Yeah.
Picked Greg, went to Montreal with Greg. 4 weeks before the shoot, Greg dropped out. So I called Peter Sarsgaard from the back of a car in Montreal. And I literally said to him, hi, I'm the asshole who didn't cast you. And I need you to come save my career. And he got on a plane and he came. And what we found was that the dynamic between Peter and Hayden was the exact same dynamic that existed between Chuck and Steven. That the movie at its core, the emotional pulse of that movie was, what happens if the least popular kid in high school has to take down the most popular kid in high school? That's what the movie's about. As heady as the journalism stuff is, it's about high school. And you could see on set that Peter was the grinder, Peter was the consummate actor, and Hayden was the movie star. And so their dynamic was perfect. And that's what made that work.
I found there's a lovely moment in the film that I should acknowledge where you talk about how journalism is the art of capturing behavior, and then you cut to a condom, which I thought was superb. But when I'm in the UK, and the way indie films were coming to us primarily in, and it's still really an indie film, isn't it? Lionsgate wasn't Lionsgate in the same ilk that we know it now. Was we'd get the word of mouth from America, and then us film nerds would import the DVD because you generally got that ahead of time. And word reached us of Shattered Glass that there was an environment and an ecosystem at that point that would support a film like yours being able to break through and being able to not just get noise in America, but because of the internet at its best, and it's gone a lot worse, granted, since, but because of the internet at its best, that the word of the film was traveling. I'm just wondering how conscious you were of that, because I know it did get a UK release in the end, and it took a little while, but how did you know you had something, and then how did you know you had something that was going beyond just the US?
Well, that came along very, very slowly. I mean, look, when you put a movie into release in the United States, you know quickly how it's going to do inside the business, because if people like it, you start getting calls from people you haven't seen in 10 years saying, oh my God, I love your movie. Like all of a sudden Brian Grazer is calling. And like people out of nowhere are calling, and you realize, oh, okay, this is tracking. When you release a movie that doesn't track, your phone just doesn't ring.
Yeah.
Like nobody wants to talk to you. It's like you've got a contagious form of cancer, and they just don't know what to say. And the people who really love you will send you that quote from Teddy Roosevelt about life lived in the arena. That's when you know your film is fucked, when they start sending you the Teddy Roosevelt quote. Oh God, they're sending the Roosevelt quote? Jesus. But I had no idea that it was having a life in outside the United States.
Yeah.
Because we were just looking at numbers. What I find about Shattered Glass more than anything I've ever worked on is that, you know, now it's 20 years later.
Yeah.
People still talk to me about it. Like they still really share their fondness for that movie with me. And it's remarkable.
Well, it's the halcyon days when a media outlet would have 15 writers and editors. That was what I was writing down when I was watching it. Just a level of resource to do it all that I just pined for a little bit, really. But sure. I found a story that they tried to get a disgraced journalist as well to, was it Jason Blair or something like that, to try and write about your movie. And what was interesting about that story was you as a first time director were very vocal about pushing back against that, that at the point as a film director, with all due respect, you probably had the least power in your career as a director. You were willing to stand up and say, no, that's bullshit.
Because it was bullshit. Jason Blair had done this terrible thing.
Okay? Yes.
And instead of being contrite and just saying, look, I lied. I made shit up. I shouldn't have.
Mm.
He wrote a book called Burning Down My Master's House. I've just found that unforgivable.
Yeah.
Like there are plenty of reasons to talk about race in America, where America needs to be examined. In this case, what Jason Blair had done had nothing to do with race.
Yeah.
He just made shit up. And I didn't want to amplify what he had done.
It was the fact of calling it out, I thought, was unusual. Just because I speak to a lot of filmmakers, particularly indie filmmakers, who have to eat a fair degree of shit fairly early on, and it just looked like you just weren't playing that game at all.
I've eaten plenty. It's not like I'm above it, but no, I wasn't going to eat that.
So those phone calls that were coming in, because I know in the midst of it all, Breach was brought to you, that Breach pre-existed before you got there. But who were the other calls? I mean, I found one story that Jerry Bruckheimer brought you in for a project. I don't know if that was around that time, but was it that level of phone call you were getting off the back of?
It was all of that. It was all of that. And it just kept happening. People, I think journalists were really flattered that someone had made a movie about journalism.
Yeah.
And I think people in the business were really thrilled that that someone wanted to tell that kind of story.
Yeah.
Because it's a small story that felt very universal to people. And yeah, I mean, you know, there were nominations and fun stuff like that. I also think that Peter Sarsgaard was such a revelation to people. I always say Peter Sarsgaard's the reason I have a career as a director. That performance was so fucking good.
I was reading an article about him, a fairly recent article about him not getting a recent Oscar nomination. And it, even now, like nearly two decades on, it was referring to him being robbed for Shattered Glass.
He should have been.
Yeah.
Should have been. And I know who got nominated that shouldn't have, who took his nomination, and it will piss me off till the day I die. But I'll be pissed off that Chris Cooper didn't get nominated for Breach too.
Well, I mean, let's go to Breach and my HD DVD copy. I bought it on the defunct format because that's how clever I am. I mean, that pre-existed, as I understand it, as the 11th Hour.
Yes.
And came to you, and you've told a story about, I think Breach is incredible. And Chris Cooper in that film is stunning. Chris Cooper is you put him in a Muppet movie, he's brilliant. You put him in Breach, he's brilliant. I'm a huge fan of Chris Cooper. But you talked there about, you've talked about over time with Breach that there were 20 to 25 drafts. And at the end of each draft that you wrote, you felt this was it. You weren't going to have to do anything else to it. And then you ended up doing another one and another one and another one. So when's the when point? When's the point where, is it a case of you run out of time and you've got to go with what you've got? Because you don't strike me as someone who goes onto a film set with an incomplete script. When is the point where you walk away from it?
You walk away from it when you lock the film. Up until the moment that you lock the film, you are still rewriting. You're rewriting in prep. You're rewriting while you're shooting. You're rewriting by editing. You are rewriting by putting music on it and amplifying certain things and muting others. You're rewriting during the mix. Everything you're doing is writing. And you do it until they take the film from you. And every part of that process needs to be celebrated.
But in terms of what you have on a page ready for day one of shooting, how much would you say that alters on your films when you're directing by the end of it?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Not a lot. By the time you get to the stage, you've heard it enough times, you know what works.
Yeah.
What often happens is if you're moving fast, you've given yourself an opportunity to write new scenes because you have time to go shoot them that you didn't think you'd have. Or you're seeing a character sort of take off in someone's performance and you want to feed that actor more to do. Or sometimes the opposite is true, where you realize a character that a performance that's not what you thought it would be, and you start to write away from that performance. Or you lose a location and you have to figure out some clever little bridge to make a scene work in another way. Like, you're always rewriting.
So on Shattered Glass, you talked when you were directing there. You've talked separately in interviews when you're directing there about you pretty much stuck to what you were doing. And as a first-time director, you're almost clinging to it by the sounds of it. How different were you as a director on Breach?
Not very. Yeah. Look, at a certain point, you just know I'm going to have to reshoot something.
Yeah.
And if you knew what it was going in, you'd be a genius. I'm not a genius. Breach and Shattered Glass both required 3 days of reshoots.
Yeah, and I mean, you directed again with Secret in Their Eyes in 2015. Was it exactly the same on that? Was it?
No, that was 1 day of reshoots. But that movie didn't turn out as well as the other two. Maybe I should have done 3 days.
But to you, presumably, that's still as important a film. That the way, you've got huge acclaim for Shattered Glass and Breach. Secrets in Their Eye, you remade a beloved film. I think you're kind of always walking into a furnace there.
It's the only thing I've ever made that I regret making.
Do you mind me asking why?
Not at all. I regret making it because the people who bet on me lost their money.
Yeah.
And that's not good. I regret making it because although there are things about it that I remain very proud of, Ultimately, we didn't get awards. We didn't get reviews. We didn't get box office. I mean, none of the metrics that you would use to measure success came our way. And I've just decided that making a movie is like raising a kid. It takes 20 years to know whether or not you did a good job.
Yeah.
It's 20 years later on Shattered Glass and Breach. And I know we accomplished something.
Yeah.
I'm not going to look at Secret in their eyes until 2035. And then I'm going to decide either the critics were right and I shouldn't have made it, or the critics were wrong. And they were in that moment, they were just too harsh.
Yeah.
But I won't know until 2035 because I'm not going to watch it until then. Until then, it's the one thing I wish I hadn't made, despite the fact that I think the performances in the movie are spectacular.
I mean, your level of perspective on stuff like this is really fascinating. And the fact that you've almost built in some rules in your head, or is it a coping mechanism, or is it just kind of the way that you are?
I guess it's a coping mechanism. I don't think you can survive in Hollywood without coping mechanisms. You know, this business just keeps kicking you in the head over and over and over again. And you got to find a way to deal with it or you're going to go insane.
Yeah. From Breach and Secret in Their Eyes, an awful lot of produced screenplays. And I appreciate we're running slightly short on time. So I wonder if I can just jump to the relationship with Paul Greengrass, again, a fellow Brit. But whenever I read production stories of Paul Greengrass films, they sound intense. That with no disrespect to Paul Greengrass, he's Bourne films. It's very well known. He'll make it, then he'll go and reshoot lots of it, and he'll rework it and rework it. And he gave this lovely quote of working with you on Captain Phillips. I just wonder if I can get your perspective on it. And he described it as an interesting collaboration. He said, he and I disagreed about absolutely everything except the things that were important. And he said this with a laugh. I'm not stirring. So and he said, we shared some fundamental instincts about things that really mattered, but then described filmmaking as, quote, a contact sport. Would you share that recollection of that experience? Because people who collaborate with him, the work that comes out the end of it always seems to be really strong, but it seems to be a battle to get there.
When Paul was brought on that movie, the script was already there and Hanks was already there.
Yeah.
And I had writers who had written for him contact me and say, you need to join a support group. I had writers say to me, writing for Paul is harder than directing. And I thought, I can handle this. And Paul and I disagreed about everything, but so respectfully and so jovially. And I began to understand Paul's process, which is he needs to deconstruct in order to reconstruct. But we went through that process together. There was one point where he had fired me for 2 days and then brought me back. And then finally we got the script exactly as he wanted it. And he went off. He was about to go off to Malta. We were having one last conversation before he left. And we're talking about some particular line of dialogue. I don't remember what it was. And he said to me, well, I always take dialogue to be something of a suggestion. And I said, Paul, I don't know what to say about that, except here's 120 pages of suggestions. Have a great time.
Extraordinary film as well. Your Academy Award nomination, of course.
Next time I saw him was at the premiere.
Is that right? Is that right? And so he goes off to make that. You watch the film for the first time. And what's your response? I mean, how much of your script did he make?
I sat there watching the cut of the movie, and it was the only time, literally the only time in my career, where I watched a cut of a movie and knew, oh, this is a hit.
Interesting. Why?
No question. I just knew it.
Even with you wrote The Hunger Games. You sit there and watch The Hunger Games.
Hunger Games came later, I think.
No, it's year before Hunger Games, 2012.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought the cut I saw of Captain Phillips was better than the cut I saw of Hunger Games.
Well, I really liked both
of
them. So.
I knew it was a hit. I knew it was such a well-made, beautifully crafted movie. No question in my mind. That performance.
Yes.
The way that movie was told, we were gold. I knew it.
I remember reading a piece, an interview Aaron Sorkin gave on the making of A Few Good Men, and how Rob Reiner would ring him in the middle of the night, just pushing him, pushing him, pushing him to improve it, improve it, improve it. And he described almost the experience as next to hell, but coming at the end of it as a better writer and with a better film. Is that kind of like a parallel of what you had?
Very much so. And except Paul never called me once he left for Malta. He didn't need anything. It was all in before he went to prep that all the torture took place then.
And another thing I read around the same time I was reading that particular article was, I think William Goldman did one of his books and he talked about writing for Clint Eastwood. And he talked about, he wrote a draft of a script for Clint Eastwood, turned up for a meeting, expecting lots and lots of pen marks and things like that. Clint Eastwood recommended two changes, said, okay, we'll go and make that. And you, of course, worked with Clint Eastwood on Richard. And again, was your experience reflective of that?
Yeah, I met him at
that's wonderful.
Met him at 1:30. He had a couple notes. He told me he was planning on prepping the movie, you know, starting in a couple days. I said, well, don't waste any time talking to me. I went home, I executed the notes, I sent them back, and that was it. Off he went.
Incredible.
It was the ultimate opposite of Paul Greengrass.
Well, that's why I put those two questions next to each other, I think. I just love the contrast there. But again, you've worked with, 20, 30 different directors? And presumably they're at completely separate ends of the spectrum.
Very much so.
Okay. So I'm nearly out of time. I do just want to ask you two more things. There was a film, because what clearly happened from the outside looking in is when you did Shatterglass, when you did Breach, and also in interviews you've given, when you were talking about true stories, when you were talking about fiction that was very linked to true stories, that almost feels like it flipped a switch. And I found one of your lost movies in the midst of a lot of lost movies, of a 2008 film that you sold to Fox Searchlight called How to Rig an Election. Which didn't come to light yet feels, let's just say, prescient. And I'm just wondering where that got lost just in the system. I wouldn't ordinarily.
I'll tell you exactly where it got lost. It was a movie that I was writing for Fox Searchlight. It was a very cynical movie about the political process.
Yeah.
Barack Obama was elected president. And the head of Fox Searchlight called me and said, we can't make this movie. There's not going to be any cynicism in politics anymore. I said, you're right. It was the end of the movie.
That simple?
Yep. We thought cynicism was out of politics forever.
And then presumably, if you tried to make it 8 years later, gone completely the other way. Its moment would have gone.
It's just small potatoes by comparison.
Yeah. I was, if I can end just by asking you this, I was watching we've got a writer in the UK, I don't know if you're familiar with him, Russell T. Davis, who's done some incredible television work over here. And there's just been quite an extensive profile done on him on British television. And he talked about, he's been writing for so long that he almost lives his day-to-day life just looking at scene directions. He sees the world just very much through a screenwriting gaze, that he's got characters in his head that he thought of decades ago that he's not found a place for yet. He's got scenes in his head that he's just waiting for the thing to come in. Is that familiar to you? What's in your head? I suppose at a very simplistic way, how do you actually write?
Well, I don't have that. I have is sometimes when people speak to me, I see it written as dialogue in a script.
Interesting.
That happens. And every once in a while, people will say something to me and I'll think, oh, I got to remember that one. That's a good one. That's going somewhere.
Yeah.
Because you can't top real human behavior. It's all so idiosyncratic and strange and wonderfully human.
And so if I can just end by just asking which projects are on the stove at the moment. You've mentioned the TV series that's moving. Is there
TV series, which I'm very, very excited about. During the Writers Guild strike, I wrote a novel.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to a publisher about that now. It's actually set in London, so you may see me around there.
Oh, lovely. Coffee.
And a couple features that I'm writing, one of which looks like it's going to start very, very soon. I don't know what I'm going to direct next, but I want to start doing that again too.
And so that 19-year-old who wrote The Jetsons, what do you think he'd make of the Billy Ray that we find today.
I suspect that 19-year-old would say, what do you mean you don't have two Academy Awards by now?
Just a matter of time, Billy Ray. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. It's been an absolute delight to have you on the podcast. Thank you.
Simon, I really appreciate it.
And that was my conversation with Billy Ray. And it also brings to the end the latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. You can find me on Twitter or X or whatever it's called, at Simon Brew. You can find Film Stories on there at Film Stories. Our website is filmstories.co.uk. Our online store for our print magazines is store.filmstories.co.uk. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. We're at YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. And you can support the podcast over at patreon.com/Simon Brew. But I think that's enough from me now. I thank you so much for listening. I thank you so much for your time. I will be back after the Christmas break with another bunch of film stories. Until then, have a lovely Christmas, have a lovely new year, and take care. Bye bye.